Hello, and welcome to episode 135 of The Crate and Crowbar. It's the 29th of March, and I am Tom Francis. With me here today are...
Chris Thurston.
And...
Tom Senior.
The biggest news of the week that we don't have anything to say about is that the Oculus Rift is out, and Palmer Luckey has flown to somewhere...
Alaska.
...to hand-deliver the first Oculus. And one of those things that sort of sounds like a nice idea, but then when he did it was sort of a bit shitty about it. It was like, I'll be damned if I'm letting some random delivery guy deliver the first Oculus. I'm like, all right.
What about it?
Might be quite
one?
A nice thrill for the delivery guy to deliver the first Oculus.
It that's literally his job.
Yeah. Like, I'll be damned if I'll let that guy do the best part of his job. I want to steal it. Anyway. None of us actually use the retail one, have we?
No, not yet.
No. Although, so I was pretty set that I was going to get a Vive at some point, but then the launch trailer for Eve Valkyrie came out today.
Oh, no.
Is that Rift exclusive?
No, but it's now, though. Like, in terms of now, which is the time frame I'm thinking about. Oh, God. I want. It might not even be that good. Like, I kind of want, independent of the VR wow, I want someone to tell me if it's a good game or not.
Yeah.
And I hope it is, because I just want a really good competitive space dogfighting game more than I want literally any other sort of game of any kind. I want that to be an esport, and I want to either cover that esport or be the single greatest person in the world at it. And I won't accept. I'll have one of those two things. That's fine. I understand if I'm not the greatest starfighter pilot, but
the best,
you know,
the best arc is that you become the best starfighter pilot and then kind of retire to become a commentator on the sport. And
yeah, that's like that's you know, I mean, and there's been highs and lows to my life so far, but that's what's missing. Like, that's the you know, the moment where the calling clicks into place. On the cusp of 30, finally realised what I was supposed to do.
I did see Giant Bomb, well, I saw a clip from Giant Bomb's kind of, I guess, playtest of the Rift, in which they, I don't know who it is who's playing, but Jeff and co are kind of telling him what to do, and he's in a racing car, and they tell him to stand up. And when he stands up, his head goes through the roof, and now he can see through the roof, and he can carry on driving like that, which is kind of cool. Then they say, take a step to the right, and then crouch. And he crouches down, he's back inside the car, and then they say, look left. And he looks left, and there's the headless driver standing there. And he's like, ah! So you can do that in the Oculus.
The exact same thing happened to me when I was playing Elite Dangerous in the Rift at Gamescom a couple of years ago, because they had a demo set up. This is like DK2 era Rift. I got up out of the cockpit, the pilot seat, and then turned around, and there was my lifeless, headless body sat in the chair that I'd left.
I wonder how long before we get the sort of, you know, inverse kinematics is the sort of technology where you can have physics or some other part of the game control part of a human body, and it will try and animate as best it can in response. So, like when your hands get pushed up against a wall in a game or something, or your legs try and balance on a moving surface, you know, the position of your feet will be driven by whatever the surface is doing, and then the legs have to kind of take care of themselves. I'm surprised we haven't already seen some prototype of a VR tech where, you know, it knows where the position of your hands and your head, and then it just tries to figure out what a human body might be doing on the basis of that.
I think I heard something that... There was something along those lines, I think. But it might have been for, like, animating, as in you're puppeteering yourself in the thing in order to animate something else rather than
right.
To see your own body. I imagine it would be too weird if it was slightly wrong.
Yeah, that's what I wanted.
Like, maybe you can get used to it.
I want to see it, especially if it's slightly wrong.
Yeah. It's interesting watching the Rift come out and be sort of accepted as a piece of technology, and people say, like, yes, it's 8 out of 10. Like, it feels like for all the many, many, many years now of people wondering whether it was going to kind of, like, bomb or set the world on fire, probably the most interesting thing is it's just come out and been accepted as a gadget that you might own that's quite good.
Mm. Yeah. It'd be interesting to see if the Vive makes a different kind of impact, because it is quite a different thing.
Yeah, it's such an expensive hobby as well, that's the thing. Like,
yeah,
I mean, you think about maybe like the highest sort of people who invest the most in games would be people who have a PC but buy every console as well. And that's going to be, you know, thousands of pounds ultimately. But getting just a Vive and a Rift is £1,000 pretty much, like straight up, even if not more.
Yeah, I think it's
like
more.
It's, yeah.
In the UK at least.
The Rift doesn't have its controllers yet, does it?
No.
No, not the motion ones.
That seems to be a huge missing factor for me.
I wouldn't have launched without them. I suppose that it was a desperate rush to like be the first to market, because it has worked out well for them in that now every major publication in the world is doing their VR issue and is, you know, on the occasion of the Rift launch. And so they're talking about the Rift when they talk about VR. Mm. And that's obviously what they want, is to be synonymous with VR. And if the Vive launched first, I think that would have been a big loss for Oculus.
In some ways, I'm surprised that the name of the product has stayed Oculus Rift. Like, I know that they got a lot of press for that name when it was a Kickstarter and stuff, but it still feels like a development prototype name for something that will one day have will not sound like a magic artifact from a fantasy game.
Yeah.
Like, the Vive is not a great name because it doesn't really mean anything, but Oculus Rift is still, like, you know, Gordon, we've got to get the resonance cascade into the Oculus Rift. Like...
In one of those things that now feels like it must have been a dream, everyone at GDC pronounced it Vive.
Vive.
And I was too embarrassed to comment on it, because if presumably they're all right and I've been saying it wrong this whole time, or I don't know, they all seem so confident in that. And all kind of.
We literally ran an event with NVIDIA where the Vive was, and they called it the Vive.
Mm. Maybe it's British English or American English.
I thought it was Vive, I mean, A, because it just kind of looks that way, but also because HTC... They don't really talk about it now, but at the time that they first announced this, they had a whole series of products that started with RE:, and then whatever came after the RE would be something that makes a word with that. And the Revive was kind of like, that made sense. And then it got shortened to Vive, but that seems like the pronunciation would make sense. Anyway, that doesn't matter really.
There's the version that I think we've tried, which is the Vive Pre.
Yeah.
So that would have been the Revive Pre. Which is back into nonsense territory, isn't it?
On a previous pod, someone wrote in to ask, like, would we ever have, like, desktop replacement in VR, so you have VR instead of a monitor? And I saw today that there is actually that software coming out this week on Steam, which is, like, virtual desktop, where it projects your monitor and what your monitor would otherwise be outputting, whether it's a game or just your desktop or a browser or something, into your field of vision at whatever size you want. It can be a curved screen or flat. And you can then interact with your PC as you normally would, but in your VR surrounding, you're actually in the middle of the desert or in space or something.
It's really cool, but it's also, like, part of me thinks that's nuts that it works. You know, it's just weird. Like, oh, you wouldn't think you could actually just make the screen bigger. But then also, it's kind of... I know that this isn't all we've done with VR, but from an outsider perspective, like, oh, we invented a technology that can take you with incredible convincingness to any world you can imagine. Let's go to a world where I have a bigger TV.
Yeah. Well, it was like, let's go to a world where I'm in the desert, or I'm in space, or I'm in the Himalayas, but I also have a bigger TV. And I'm looking at Twitter on it.
Yeah, I'm still doing the same shit.
Yeah, exactly. I would kind of, that's the stuff that kind of gets me, is kind of like weird and... sort of futuristic in that, will that be like standard teleconferencing stuff in the future? Will you kind of like dial into a Google Hangout but actually see the other people rather than just see like...
Well, Microsoft showed off that like Hollow Presence thing.
Yeah.
Which is like real-time 3D scanning and... texturing of you. So like you stand in a room full of cameras basically, and then so does the other person across the world, and it basically models you in real time and projects you over to the other person's world while they're wearing a HoloLens, which is a mixed reality thing where you see both the augmented reality where you see both the digital stuff and the real world, and basically makes that person appear in your room. But with the they look, although this technology is obviously cutting edge, it looks like kind of 90s PS2 games or something. And so everyone's like slightly low poly and the texture's slightly misapplied because it's doing it in real time, which is a difficult challenge.
Does everyone just look like Max Payne? Just smeared across a kind of
bloody... You're remotely present with your family when they miss you, but you will look like Max Payne.
They secretly replace everyone's model with Max Payne and no one notices.
But it's,
and you also need a room full of cameras.
Yeah, it's so cumbersome that it just seemed kind of like less personal. And also the guy who demoed it showed it by like showing how he could hang out with his daughter, like his six-year-old daughter. And his six-year-old daughter obviously isn't wearing a HoloLens and a bunch of other stuff, so she can't see him. So she's just like alone in a room talking to this disembodied voice of her dad who's saying, and she's saying like, come home,
let's
daddy.
Let's go to Dagobah.
And she looks like a tiny Max Payne.
To him, yeah. Luckily, she can't see him as a giant Max Payne because she can't see anything at all.
The future of bonding right here, parental
yeah,
bonding.
Yeah.
But then they seem to like showcase all the things that don't work about it, which is like, A, she doesn't have a HoloLens, so she can't see him. And he comments on that fact, which is highlights how it's not working. And then also, like, she wants to play with a toy and he can't touch it because he's in a different world. It's just like, here's all the things that are tragic and sad about this technology.
This is his Dark Materials, isn't it? I still want one, though.
I love that they've invented it without really knowing what it's for yet. I love that the humans have done that with virtual reality. It's like, we'll find a use for it, but we haven't found it yet, actually.
It's kind of, I don't know, it's like, game-wise, it's a whole new world of possibilities and weird interfaces and new logic and all the things we thought were true about how you get players comfortable in the game and what they can do and what they like doing, what they don't like doing are all different in VR, and so all that knowledge gets thrown out and you learn it all again. But I'm, as a, you know, relatively new game designer, I haven't got used to the old rules yet. I don't know, like, do I want to move into a whole new set of rules where we already don't know anything? In a way, then my lack of experience is less of a disadvantage. But on the other hand, I was getting quite involved in learning how, you know, screen-based games work.
Hmm. It's interesting to me, like, how much of the, like, a not insubstantial portion of the Rift launch lineup is games like tower defense games and strategy games and stuff, where you're looking down on the battlefield like it's right in your face. Mm. You're kind of peering down on it and using your gaze as a cursor, which is like the last use for VR I would have really imagined. Like, I would have definitely put my money on big library of VR experiences. Like, Adrift is out this week.
Oh, yeah.
Although, amusingly, if you search for Adrift, you won't find it. You have to search for Adronft. Which is what it's actually called. But yeah, like, you know, Adronft is a VR launch game. That makes complete sense to me because it's like a kind of, you know, astronaut stranded in space experience, which is, you know, perfect. But like, oh God, what's the tower defense series? Always been on Steam, always been huge. Has like an announcer in Dota, and because it's got like a sardonic AI. God damn, whatever. Defense Grid is out on Rift, and I mean, I know it's on everything, but it's like, that's, and it's a good game, but it's like literally the last game I would think of when I was like, what are people going to be playing on there?
You're imagining kind of beautiful immersive worlds to explore, and you just get battle chess, and that's actually what you get. what is this good for? Battle chess.
But actually, all I would play is spaceship games. Like, that's what it is. It's the spaceship game helmet. And I still want one. And that's notwithstanding the fact that there's a fucking Star Wars thing coming out for the Vive.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hold a lightsaber.
Where you can pluck a lightsaber out of R2-D2's beautifully realised dome and swing it pointlessly on Tatooine. And I'm in for £600. What other fresh releases?
There's some Fallout news, right?
Fallout 4's survival mode is now in beta. Anyone can access it via Steam in the kind of right-click menu on Steam. You can just go to the beta section and try out the survival mode beta, which none of us have played, but we thought was newsworthy enough to mention it in case you'd drifted away from Fallout 4. So it resets the rules to make it a more survivalistic wasteland where meat can kill you if it's not properly cooked and stuff. And, you know, you have to drink water and, you know, things.
So something like resting doesn't heal you or something? Or
yeah, certain injuries just won't heal as well, I think. and things just generally take ages to heal.
I think, I remember reading the rules and it was like, resting no longer heals your crippled limbs or whatever, and you have to use a stim pack. And I thought, I would rather they'd done the opposite change, because the stim packs are the things that feel cheap to me. I had like 79 of them or something, and so anything that happened, I could just instantly heal it away with magic syringes. Whereas if I had to go and sleep to recover, that would be a more kind of serious penalty.
Yeah, maybe I'd probably gone for like remove stim packs because they are a magic solution to healing.
Yeah.
And say that rest will heal minor things, and for major things, you have to go to a doctor in one of the towns.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Like, so you have to get, you know, you have to drag yourself broken legs and all to.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to trying it, but it's always the thing of, because Bethesda's approach to expanding their games increasingly seems to be to kind of have game jams internally and then develop things, which is really exciting. But at the same time, a lot of their expansions and kind of updates feel like mods as a result, in a way that they don't seem to have, like, they might be more polished than a mod, but not necessarily as polished as you might expect from a full studio release. And so it'd be interesting to see how this survival mode, which feels like a lot, or already feels a lot like a mod, just based on the fact it's making some basic rule changes, how it stacks up against other realist survival mods. Yeah. And how that's like I can imagine people using it as a springboard to make those alterations that you guys just suggested, for example, and kind of turning it into the thing they want it to be. But it's a cool kind of, I think it's a free update as well, which is really neat.
Because with, was it Skyrim or was it even a...
Skyrim had Frostfall, which was the environmental survival mod for that.
Yeah, I was thinking of, in terms of like their internal game jams, they did one for Skyrim for sure.
Oh, right.
And they tried like rideable dragons and throwing spears and all this other stuff. And one of the things they tried was like building, like sort of having a home and building it up a bit. And then that became like a proper full-fledged DLC. And then that also became like the sort of the big thing in Fallout 4, right? That
was
their
big
headline feature, was building a whole town. So it can kind of grow into more.
Yeah, it was Hearthfire, wasn't it? For
yeah, that's it.
Skyrim, but there were only kind of three or four preordained locations where you could build.
Yeah.
And apparently it's quite a big resource grind to get it up, and there wasn't a huge amount of customization.
And then you could like creepily adopt kids.
Yes.
And
yeah, you could literally walk up to them in the street and be like, "Do you not have any parents? Good news. I'm your dad now." Because
there was also a Fallout DLC is probably out, right? The Automaton one.
Automatron,
yeah. Or Automatron, as I kept reading.
And that lets you get a robot companion that you can maybe upgrade or change in some way.
It's quite a lot of customization to it, apparently. There's kind of Nemesis who customizes their own pet robot, and you make them fight and stuff.
Excellent.
I know Phil reviewed it for PC Gamer and gave it 60-something.
65, I think,
so,
which is the score that almost all Bethesda RPG DLC tends to get for the reasons we kind of said before. In that
it's three or four all right hours for a bit of money.
I think which one was really good was marshy one for Fallout 3.
Point Lookout.
Yeah.
God damn, I don't remember that.
It was
absolutely
beautiful, misty marshland, kind of a horrible swamp full of, like, mutant hicks who would, like, yell, like, "You're in the wrong place, girl!" And I was playing a female character. I don't know if the plot was any good because I didn't really follow it, but it was like a huge chunk of new land, and it was just looked so different to Fallout 3 and had its own atmosphere and was just kind of this really... like bleak, kind of starkly beautiful place with some nasty Maya lurks.
What did you give it?
I can't remember.
66.
The highest score allowable for DLC. I think the thing I usually suffer from is just like they give you a massive 60-hour chunk of game, and then they like add a bit more to it. And it's like, I don't care about hours 60 to 63 because I'm still on hour 45. And so like stuff like survival is much more interesting to me because that's changing the game rather than adding to it.
It's always the slightly formulaic in the sort of the expectations what you get from it. It's always like quest line, minor new feature, guns and armor set.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, you finish that loop too many times and I feel like that's why survival's appealing, because it's not just like, oh, I did the virtual reality one in Fallout 3 where you fight the Chinese army with laser guns and now I've got an electric katana, which I will take into the next one, a swamp. Like, I get my swamp-themed armor.
I wonder what it would feel like if those were in there from the start. Because as DLC, they feel like sort of theme park rides where it's all around one theme and it's all very self-contained. But if you came across that as like a lone quest out in the world without knowing it's going to be there, maybe that would feel amazing. Like, it would feel like, wow, there's this whole completely different adventure going on.
Yeah, I think I actually sort of advocate that with DLC in general, like, because they always do that thing that I find quite annoying where it's like when you've installed the DLC, or especially if you load up the game with all the DLC installed, whatever point it is in the, like, if you install a Game of the Year edition, for example, this is always a problem where you hit the threshold where the game is allowed to give you those quests, and suddenly it's like 8 new radio signals detected, and it's 50 different people. And then, like, I reloaded my Skyrim save the other day, actually, just to go back and see if it still worked, because I had, you know, I'd screwed around with the game modding it for a long time and then hadn't gone back to my original mod-free version of the game. And the moment I stepped outside my house in Whiterun, like 8 different dudes ran at me. Like 2 cultists, a messenger, someone else. And they're all like just falling over each other to tell me like the 4 or 5
You've inherited
different...
a house. You're the king of this. We need
you're
to
my dad
this.
Now.
And become important to a lot of quest lines.
Whereas like I would actually, at least like the option with open world DLC to tick the fold this into the game box rather than the I don't want this straight away. Like, I'm happy to just encounter this. Like, so know it's there somewhere, but not have it thrown at me the moment I log in.
It's so rare that they get this right, because I remember, like, some of the first DLCs that I ever played, I can't remember if they were for, I don't think they were Oblivion, but something like that. I'd buy the DLC, install it, and just have no idea how to find the thing. Like, it probably was folded into the world really elegantly, but I had no idea where to go to find it, because there was no kind of documentation, I guess. And then Oblivion started, it didn't have anything as elegant as people running up to you, but it just had dialogue boxes that popped up, and it would literally, like, one of the ones you could install did pop up the message saying, you've inherited a house in this place, and click here to go there now. And that was just, like, the cheapest thing.
Yeah. But even the, like, all the Fallout Radio thing is just, I don't know, there has to be a more elegant way of doing it. Or simply just give people the option. Like, there are mods, actually, weirdly, there are mods, I think, for Skyrim that do exactly that. There's this one, I forgot what it's called, there's a timings mod, basically, that allows you to set thresholds that allow the things that are all scheduled to happen at once to happen. Like, don't let this quest line start until I'm level 20 plus.
Sorry.
Like, if it's a late game thing. I don't know, the more control you give people over that kind of experience, the better.
Yeah, you don't know what's going to break the integrity of a world for a player, do you? So it's kind of better to give them the options themselves.
But it's a kind of, I guess it's weird to ask, like, if someone's not opted into a mod, for them to sort of go up to them and say, if we were to start adding vampires, when would that be weird for you?
Yeah,
is it weird now? Would it be weird in 2 hours? Because, yeah, the answer's probably going to be like, no, I want to see a vampire for a lot of people.
What have you been playing, Dom?
I've been playing a game called Guilty Gear Xrd Sign.
That sounds like one of them Japanese games.
It's a 2D beat 'em up, and it's a very long running series that I first encountered at university when I picked up Guilty Gear 2XX from a bargain bin in a local co-op supermarket, and for the PlayStation 2, and played it, and it's one of the most kind of nuts, strange 2D beat-em-ups that you could probably hope to accidentally find in a bargain bin anywhere in the world. And turns out to actually be a long-running and, like, really competitive and incredibly technical fighting game, even though the main character's name is Soul Bad Guy. And one of the...
Is that Soul, like, as in, like, a...
The sun.
Thing that goes
the
on.
Sun, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, SOL bad guy. And one of the new characters is a person in a bed, but the bed's a giant robot that he's controlling with his dreams.
That is the dream, I think.
Yeah, sorry?
That is the dream.
That is the dream. And it's brilliant. It's pretty good. Really, really good. Fast-paced, kind of high-pressure beat-em-up about kind of charging. The game literally punishes you if you go backwards too much by draining your kind of tension resource that you use to do a lot of the more advanced moves in the game.
It's too relaxed back there.
So you're forced to constantly charge, and the feeling of charging in the game is really exciting, partly because of the animations. And one of the great things that Guilty Gear Xrd Sign does that is new to the series is that it's a 2D game that, for the life of you just looking at it, you would think, oh, it's just a series of animated cell frames that these characters are they're just animated in the way that you'd animate a 2D fighter, except they're actually 3D models, but with the kind of low frame rate animations of a 2D game. And it's interesting because frames are very, very important to Guilty Gear because it's such a technical fighter. The point at which you interrupt or cancel or, you know, activate a lot of the kind of explosive counterattack moves rely a lot on frames, and a lot of the kind of most advanced combos rely on activating the second string as you're hitting a certain frame of an animation. So the kind of low frame rate of the animation it speaks to its favor because it helps you to better pick out the part of the combat that you're supposed to activate. But the amazing thing is it's made in Unreal Engine, and for special moves, the camera just goes, will rotate around these characters that you thought previously were just 2D models, and it turns out it's like magic. It's like, what? How did this happen? And it's a really, really clever way of updating an old kind of old school way of animating fighters into a modern engine, into a modern era. And it's also brilliant because it's got just the most absurd characters, like this doctor who wears a paper bag over his head and wields a giant scythe, who kind of invades the battlefield from the Doctor universe via a giant door. So a door opens in the floor and he kind of like comes out of it. And
yeah. How do you know it's a Doctor universe?
It's because you see it occasionally. And it's just like a... He'll run out of it to do special moves, and like his intro to the battle is sometimes he's running down like a medical corridor and he says, "I'm ready to operate now," and he opens the door into the universe of the fighting arena, and you see it's very, very strange. This game is really, really, really unusual. The designs are so bizarre. There's a little girl with a giant anchor that's twice the size of her, and she throws the anchor at enemies, obviously standard, but for special moves she summons giant pink whales, and she could summon her fireball is basically dolphins, but as the dolphins are kind of jumping towards enemies, you can actually jump your character onto the dolphin and ride dolphins in to activate combos and start doing things. So it's this amazing mix of incredibly creative, colourful character design and ideas for characters, which also sinks into this incredibly technical, difficult and creative fighting system in which every character is like markedly different, and some of them have their own mechanics. Like there's one character that has to just keep eating. And he can combo, and a lot of his kind of he's got really high combo potential, because while he's full and while he's kind of fueled with burgers, he could just chain things far more effectively than other characters. But there comes a point where he has to stop and eat a burger, at which point it's quite likely to get fucked up by Soul Bad Guy and his giant gun blade that shoots fire. And I'm so glad it's on PC, and I'd really, really recommend it. And I, as a new fighter, if you're looking for a new fighting game, it's a better new player experience by a long, long way than Street Fighter V. It has an amazing tutorial that teaches you like every aspect of its extraordinarily arcane combat system, which involves things called Roman cancels. three varieties of Roman cancel.
That sounds like quite a good pun in English.
And we press three buttons.
Not to be confused with the Gregorian cancel.
the Roman cancel is a stalwart part of the series, and there are three versions now, you'd be pleased to know: red, yellow, and I think purple, and they all do various different things. They all let you chain attacks together differently. It comes as highly recommended. I think it's brilliant.
I think Andy Hamilton, Midnight Resistance Andy, who's done some stuff for PC Gamer Pro on fighting games, recommended its tutorial as like the way into this genre, given only it, I think it and Skullgirls are the two games that have really, really good tutorials. Which is a weird thing to say in a world where Street Fighter V is a new game that's just come out.
Yeah, well, especially when Capcom were talking about how it would be a good new user experience for players who weren't into fighting games. But Guilty Gear is far, far better at it.
Five, actually, topically, this week is getting its big fix.
Oh, great.
That came out today, the patch, and then the new characters out will be out by the time this podcast goes out. So apparently, like, stuff like the online lobbies not working and all that stuff is fixed, and the store, which is like where you spend your battle points on new hats for your battle people, that's on now. So it feels like that game's kind of coming into... I've only been playing a lot of it because lunchtime Street Fighter is now a thing very much in the office.
I really like the game, actually.
Street Fighter 5 is great. Yeah. It's just, I don't know why they released half a game.
Yeah, bizarre as well. Was it because of the pro scene? Did they have to get a build out before...
the pro tour? Possibly. Pro tour possibly, yeah. But even so, like, I mean, just today was editing something about how people in the pro scene are a little bit unhappy about this, because fighting games aren't traditionally the games that get patched. They are the games where people learn the ins and outs of a build over the course of a year, including all those frame timings and everything else. So Capcom just changing something between tournaments with a balance patch other games that's much more common, but it's totally not the way things normally have been historically for that community.
I mean, for fighting games, they tend to be like separate arcade releases that tend to put in those balance changes. Much slower kind of rhythm to it.
I mean, you're talking about a community that, you know, really, really cares about the refresh rate of a television.
Yeah.
Because it makes that much of a difference. So I can imagine if you just remove a technique between versions, that's suddenly like blasphemy, or just adding a character all of a sudden.
Or saying that this, EX fireball will no longer chain into this particular kick, like that has massive and obvious connotations.
Yeah, because people's actual muscle memory as well.
Quite right.
I mean, the other thing is Killer Instinct, which formerly Xbox exclusive, is out on PC this month as well. It's part of this kind of ongoing fighting game on PC Renaissance thing.
Which is great.
Which is apparently a really good game, right. Which I wasn't expecting because I had Killer Instinct for the Game Boy when I was a kid, and it was just like the game you got if you didn't have Mortal Kombat or Street Fighter.
Yeah.
But it's a free-to-play game where you buy the characters and skins and stuff, but apparently competitive scene's going well. People seem to really like it.
Oh, great.
You can play as a Battletoad. And the Arbiter from Halo.
Wow.
Because it's a Microsoft tie-in game. So, yeah, it's a weird little side project Microsoft's got cooking in the first party house.
That's interesting. Because I played an old Killer Instinct, and it always felt like a combo memory game as much as anything else. But I'll be interested to try it and see if it's got its own kind of deep systems.
So, yeah, it's all happening.
Yeah, it's exciting. I'm so glad that fighting games come into PC more frequently.
What are you playing, Chris?
I've been playing a game called The Culling, which is...
Sounds nice.
I started playing because they have some sort of competitive ambitions for it. What it is a competitive short-form survival game. It's in early access on Steam at the moment. Costs a tenner. It's... So, I mean, and I say that because it sort of sits between a whole bunch of different things, but it's a... It's a survival game in that you are on an island. You can punch the ground to make rocks. You can punch rocks together to make knives. And then you can hit trees to get sticks. And then add sticks to knives to get spears and so on. There's no food or anything like that because it's such a form. But it's also fundamentally the Hunger Games. It's a game show. There are, I don't know how many players, about 20 players. You queue for a multiplayer session. And then the last player surviving wins. And it's locked at, I think, 25 minutes or half an hour. And as time goes on, like events on the map, like airdrops and stuff that might bring players together. A lot of those sort of like game design ideas from the Hunger Games, like, you know, the ways they get, if you've seen those movies or read those books, the way they get contestants to kind of clash, that stuff happens. And even some ideas sort of almost borrowed wholesale from the Hunger Games, like, the scoreboard isn't a UI thing, it's in the sky. Like, you look up at a certain angle and it's projected into the sky. It's like, who's still alive and who's dead and stuff like that. And so all of your kind of like scavenging and finding stuff is all kind of has to take place within this 25-minute period. And over time, like, as time gets on, like, sections of the map get closed off by poisonous gas that emerges from these vents and stuff. And I really like the idea because... In as much as it is a Steam early access survival game about going through lockers, hoping you find the good gear, like the sort of DayZ stuff, it also reminds me a lot of, like, we were talking about things that feel like mods. Like, it has that kind of, it's another one of those games with that kind of golden era of Half-Life multiplayer game design experiment about it. Like, I can imagine, you know, from the other angle, I can imagine this game being made by people who wanted to find a new way of doing multiplayer within any FPS engine. It doesn't necessarily have to have come from the DayZ sort of survival angle. I mean, indeed, it's as heavily inspired by Hunger Games maps for Minecraft, which is a thing that is a sort of, you know, I've not personally done, but I know is a thing people like. So I really like the idea, and actually it could be really entertaining as a spectator thing. Because the way it works currently is when you die, you can then choose to quit and queue for a different game, in which case your match can be at different people, or just continue as a spectator and watch the rest of the match. So it's pretty brutal, because you have all this stuff and you gain, you hope you're doing well, and then you just get fucking murdered. But I quite like that it packs that arc from a traditional survival game into, like, it gives it a purpose. Rather than it just being like DayZ, where it's like, how long can I survive? And death is a sort of nebulous possibility, but you're not really ever, you know, you're not actively like seeking other people out and killing them. This game sort of brings about those circumstances at a more accelerated, deliberate pace to a competitive end. So it's actually quite a nice match of things.
So what happens if the timer expires and there's more than one of you alive?
I think by that point the gas is kind of like completely encroached onto the center of the map, right. Is an arena. So yeah. I think by that point it's just like two of you or three of you, whatever, in an arena in the center of the map, and it's then on you to determine that. I don't know if there's a time limit after that or everyone dies or something, but yeah, I'll get onto the rougher things about it. But like the first time I played it, I didn't really know what I was doing, but I did manage to find like a pair of brass knuckles and a steel tripwire trap, and I could hear someone being murdered around the corner of this like aircraft hangar. So I set my trap like around the corner, and then ran around the corner and just started like punching the air at the guy who now murdered the other person with a spear. As he started chasing me, and then I ran around the corner intending to lure him into my trap. But then I couldn't remember where my trap was. Then I ran into my trap, and then I was murdered with a spear. Second time I played, I went to this, ended up in the same aircraft hangar. He spawned closer to it this time because the map stays the same. Your spawn location changes. You know, managed to make myself a spear this time. No, I managed to make myself a bow. And then I got into a fight with the man with the spear, and I was murdered by the man with the spear. Third time I played, I very, very quickly made a spear, and I heard footsteps near me.
Spotting a pattern.
Yeah. Just looking, I just heard someone nearby with, and I ran into this sewer pipe, and there was a man running around in there, and he had a really fancy, like, recurve bow, and he fired at me, and he missed, and then I murdered him with the spear and took his recurve bow, and then it went really well. Like, I encountered one person and fired an arrow at him, but he ran away, and I found loads of really good stuff, and I had, like, a Bowie knife and my bow, and I'm sort of stalking the wilderness. And I'm hearing people die, and you can look up at the sky and see who's getting lots of kills and who's died. And it seems quite even, like everyone's killed one person, one guy's killed two. And then I see this guy run past, and then he vanishes. And so I go looking for him, and then this like blow dart comes out of a bush, hits me, and my vision starts to go blurry. So I start firing arrows at him, missing. And then I think I hit him, because then he shot me with a gun. So I've been poisoned, then he shot me with a gun. Then he bum rushed me. Then he tased me, and then he beat me to death with a wrench.
Like Rasputin.
Yeah. But then I kind of watched that guy kind of continue onwards, and he was doing that. Like he would find somebody, then hide, and then like as they went looking for him, like blow dart them and so on. And then he got in a really cool fight with somebody. Like as the gas started to go off, and it was just the two of them like sprinting to stay out the gas, but also trying to kill each other. And at one point, he just sort of like fucking went into the gaslight. He walloped the guy with a wrench and then ran. And you see the guy like kill down behind him. So that stuff is all really cool.
Nice.
I haven't come anywhere near close to winning or anything. So that stuff I really like. I think it's got loads of potential. There's like the early access stuff is mostly, I think, game balance, and like there are textures missing from certain buildings and geometry and stuff like that. So it's definitely alpha. The stuff that's not great is it's pretty ugly despite being like an Unreal Engine game that's quite like high fidelity. Like it's high fidelity, but a bit sort of ugly look. It looks like, so all the character designs and the sort of like the palette of the world, it feels like a kind of like latter day decline of Tony Hawk's era skating game. Like there are only male characters. There's a slider to change the gender, but they haven't implemented it yet. But everyone looks like a twat. Like you're all in like sort of, you unlock new clothes as you go. Like my guy is now in like a kind of giant orange boonie hat, orange t-shirt and orange running shorts, just because I wanted to be as conspicuous as possible. But also because it makes you look less like a douchebag. Like it is very kind of like bro douchey dudes on an island killing each other, like kind of slightly, I don't know, it's not like Hunger Games has that kind of like, you know, subdued dystopian thing about it, whereas this is kind of, it's explicitly kind of played for laughs. And to that end, it also has an announcer who announces people have been killed and stuff. Who sounds a lot like the Dean from Community, and the Dean announcements at the start of, I think, every episode of Community, or most of them. But while some of the humor works, because it is going for sort of, you know, that kind of tongue-in-cheek black humor portal kind of thing, some of it is okay. Some of it is a bit shit. So, you know, there'll be an event where like a mystery box full of loot will be dropped somewhere on the map, and you can kind of see it coming in. It's designed to kind of drag players towards a location to get the loot. But the announcer will be bellowing like, "It's time to grab my package, everyone! Who's going to grab my package?" And it's like, oh, come on. Like, it's not that the game shouldn't be funny, because I think funny is probably the right tone for it, because it'll end up slapstick and weird anyway, because that's the kind of game it is. But, like, it's not, and so it's not a question of like, the actor not doing it right or anything else. It's just like, if you're going to go for like jokes, particularly when those jokes are going to repeat because they're an announcer in a game, the writing has to be like really, really, really fucking sharp. And it's like it has to be better than it would normally be. Like it has to be better than you would do for a single player game where the player might only hear those lines once. Like it has to, every joke has to be hilarious, or you should give players the option to switch it off. And at the moment, I think that's something they need to... That's the thing that probably has me most worried that it could get annoying over time, is that the tone of it is sort of a bit kind of like... Yeah,
douchey.
A bit douchey. It's a bit douchey for what is otherwise a really, I think, very interesting game. Because I'm not into survival games at all, but I think it's an example of like, you can take... of when making something competitive fixes a whole bunch of its problems because it gives it a purpose beyond, like, climbing the loot treadmill isn't just, like, a pointless thing you do for the sake of it. It's like, this is how I win this game that has a defined endpoint, is by getting ahead, which is kind
of
nice.
I suppose we haven't seen loads of these.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, everyone, I remember, like, when Far Cry was first announced, like, several of my friends all said, God, imagine a Battle Royale game on this island.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the Hunger Games was quite successful by taking the Battle Royale formula. And Hunger Games mods for Minecraft were hugely successful.
DayZ was really big.
Yeah.
Survival games really, yeah.
Lots of hints that this kind of game could do well.
Yeah, it is a logical conflux of a whole bunch of different things. But yeah, so, you know, I don't regret picking it up for tenner and I'll continue playing it. The other thing actually I do want to try is it also has a team mode where you're in teams of two. And that might bring it to life a bit more as well. Like, I'd like to try that. That might be fun. It feels like it would be also a brilliant, like, LAN game. I don't know if they support LAN play at the moment. I suspect they don't. But I am making that up just because they talk about servers going down. So I think it might all be online at the moment. But I can imagine it being the game that if you had all your mates, if you had all your PCs in one building, would be kind of amazing to play over the course of a long day. See who wins and what strategies develop and how people learn the map and things like that.
Yeah.
So it's got loads of potential, I think. It's a bit douchey. What have you been playing, Tom?
I've been playing Hitman, the new one. Hitman 2016, I'm going to call it.
Because
they didn't give it a proper name, so I'm going to...
Isn't it the only Hitman game that doesn't have a subtitle?
Well, yes, but A, some people don't remember that the first one had a subtitle, and B, the actual executable that runs, because I like when I take videos and stuff, it names the file after the executable that's running, which is not necessarily the same as the name of it in Steam or whatever, and the executable is called Hitman Codename 47. Like, for fuck's sake, you already took basically the name of the first game, now you're specifically taking the whole subtitle of it as well. But they don't market it that, so it's not that bad. But anyway, I'm going to call it Hitman 2016. So it's out now. And we've talked about the beta before, which was two levels. And it's doing this weird episodic thing. So the thing that's out now is not the full game. It's I think of it as one level, but really it's three. But basically there's two introductory levels, and then there's Paris. And Paris is the big sort of proper mission where it's one massive location that's kind of labyrinthine and sprawling and has hundreds and hundreds of people in it. And there's a main mission to do, which is kind of the only bit of it that is sort of on the critical path, I guess, of the full game, although who knows because it's not out yet. And then there's also loads of other kind of contracts and stuff you can do on the same level. Like it'll just pick a different person for you to kill and give you some situation of how to do that. But the two levels before that are what the beta was. So the beta was just the introductory levels and not Paris. And those, I didn't play the beta because I thought I wanted to wait until it was kind of ready. But I sort of regret it now because when you have this massive, spectacular hub level and then two much smaller missions before it, particularly because the two missions before it are made of wood. Everything in them is made of wood. All the people are supposedly stunt people, and none of the kills are really kills. But in-game, there's no difference. They just tell you that you're not really killing anyone, and they're all just actors, which makes no sense on any level. But the levels are sort of like shitty plywood reconstructions of locations. The idea is it's a training mission, and you are being tested on famous hits that from like legendary hitmen, and you're supposed to do what that original assassin did. They just feel like garbage compared to, not that they're bad, but just like it's such a weird decision because it makes you, they just signal to you at every stage, not a real level, not a real game, not really playing it, it's not really happening. And then they have a proper level. So to me, it just feels like there's one level and there's two introductory tutorial things. And I think those actually are quite complicated and you can play them a bunch of different ways, but I don't want to because I've been given this main one. Anyway, they're sort of like, the thing I'd heard about this new one was, although it's only one mission, with the aforementioned caveats, that it was basically like back to Blood Money. It was, you know, the thing that Hitman Absolution strayed away from. And it was, you know, a mission with just hundreds of different ways to do it and loads of freedom and stuff. And a bunch of that is true, but I wish I could say it was recapturing the Blood Money feeling for me, and it's not. It's it is a huge place. There's absolutely nothing you could say about its size or its complexity or its the number of routes or the number of kind of things going on in it is not only up to Blood Money standards, but like beyond it. I also think most of the systems they've changed are really good. One of the things I did like about Hitman Absolution was the concept of their disguise system was good, which was disguise has always been a bit fuzzy in Hitman because they can't make it perfect because then it becomes trivial to get everywhere. But if they make it, people shooting you on sight, it feels absurdly harsh. And then if they make it fuzzy in betweeny, then it just becomes really ambiguous and you don't know whether you're going to get shot or not. And that was, you know, kind of a problem with Blood Money. Once you played it enough, you got a sense for what you could and couldn't do, but it was always a bit weird. Absolution changed it so that what you were wearing determined how suspicious different people would be of you. So dressing as a cop was great for everyone except other cops, and other cops would know that you weren't really a cop. So if you got too close, they would be the fuzzy ones, and they would, like, you know, have varying degrees of suspicion of you depending on how close you got to them. And that was a good theory, and it made sense, but the problem with it was, almost every level, cops were the dominant force, so you needed a cop uniform to get anywhere. There was no use dressing as a chef, because the chef wasn't allowed anywhere except the kitchen, so it was pointless. So you had to dress as a cop, and then all the guards were cops, so it just became the fuzzy thing again. It just became like everyone was suspicious of you all the time if you were wearing a decent disguise. The way the new Hitman tweaks it, which is really good, is if you dress as, say, a bodyguard, not all of the other bodyguards know all the other bodyguards by face, only a few of them do. And those are just marked by just a white dot above the head. And that is used both to show you who knows, who will be suspicious of you if you get close, and also it's just kind of their universal language for this person, if they see you, you're in trouble. So if you, for example, just in your normal suit, just go behind into a trespassing area, everyone will have those dots above their head because they will all be suspicious of you if they see you. If you're dressed in a certain disguise, then only the people who know that you're not really that person will be suspicious of you. And that's a really good system, basically, because it means that there is room to maneuver. There is hard and fast rules, and there's still the fuzzy thing, but it's only on certain people, so you can just steer well clear of them, and you get these cool moments where you're kind of like... I was leaving the mission at one point in a bodyguard's disguise that I'd used, and it served me well to get to my target. And then just on the entrance, like near the gate, the place I come in through, and I passed this guy on the way in, he had a dot above his head. And when I was coming in a normal suit, he didn't care because the public were allowed to be here. But now I'm pretending to be a bodyguard, and he knows the bodyguards. So I was just like strolling out of the main entrance, and then sort of very casually veering right and just strolling back in again, thinking, okay, I need another route out. So it has cool moments like that. The thing that doesn't work for me is that Blood Money, you know, had all these different ways of doing missions, and that was the cool thing about it. They've sort of interpreted that into a very long list of what they call opportunities, which are, you will hear two guys talking about, oh, how the target wants this particular cocktail, but they don't know how to make it, and the recipe's somewhere in the basement. And that means you go and find the recipe, then you dress as a waiter, then you go to the bar, and you press the button that enables the, bartending animation when the target comes up to the bar, and then you can serve him his cocktail and poison it, and he will rush to the bathroom. And that is, you can choose how guided that is. If you leave it by default, they will tell you every part of that. They'll tell you, like, here's the opportunity, it's to make a cocktail, go to this place and get the disguise, and then go to this place and get the cocktail, and then go to this place and poison him. You can turn that off so it doesn't tell you that, but it's still fundamentally just loads and loads of pre-scripted solutions. And Blood Money had like a couple, like each mission would have kind of usually one accidental way to do it, or not accidental, pre-planned way to do it. Often it would be an accident. It would be arrange it so that the guy shoots the other guy with a real gun instead of a prop gun during the performance. But that was, to me, that was never the interesting one. It was like, it was cool that you could do that, but it was always a one-shot novelty thing. Once you'd done it once, you'd never do it again. And the more interesting thing was just that it was a huge space to play around with. And so on that opera mission where you can replace a prop gun for a real gun, I did that once and it was cool, but then the rest of the time it was about finding the right balcony from which I could unfold my sniper rifle briefcase and then take out like two people at once with a headshot that goes through both of them, and that like neatly solves the problem in some ways.
And so far, I haven't been able to do much of that in the new Hitman. It's worth saying that, like, most of my favorite moments in Blood Money were, you know, my 16th and 17th playthroughs of their missions. But it's also worth saying that I've played this mission three times now. I don't really want to play it again. I've done a whole bunch of the ways of doing it, but weirdly, they've counteracted the fact that there's loads of options by restricting loads of those options by putting all of your equipment behind an unlock system. And the way you unlock stuff is to gain mastery of the level, and the way you gain mastery is to just do all those opportunities, all those preordained ways of doing it. You just got to do them, and you get 1,000 points for each one, and I've got to get another 4,500 points before I level up, and that will get me from level 4 to 5, at which point apparently I get the sniper rifle, which I don't have at the moment. But I don't know how long it is. Apparently, like, level 10 is the silver ballers, so that's going to be another, like, 15 or 20 achievements I've got to get before I'll unlock that. I don't know when I get the opportunity to have remote detonated bombs. They weirdly replace your remote detonated bomb that you have in the tutorial with the proximity one for this mission, and to get the real one back, you've got to unlock it by doing all these achievements. Mm. And it's not very good at communicating that stuff, and also I just don't want that stuff locked behind. I don't want to have to do these opportunities. I don't want to just go through the list of, here are all the ways you should do it. Like, drop a speaker on him, do this, do this, do that.
You can see how the episodic structure is basically, it means that they feel they have to create some sort of lengthy curve to it that will actually take players, you know, time to unlock. If it had been one release, they probably wouldn't feel the need to put those leveling restrictions.
Yeah, exactly. Because the way it works in Blood Money is you know, the early missions of Blood Money, you don't have all this cool equipment. You have to unlock it, but you unlock it by playing through the whole game, which is something I'm happy to do and was excited to do. You know, I get to see new missions and do cool stuff. They don't have that ready for us yet, so we can't play through the whole game to unlock this stuff. And then, so the prescriptive solutions aren't that satisfying. And then the kind of freeform stuff that I was enjoying so much in Blood Money, A, is hampered by the fact I don't have much equipment, so there aren't many options that way. And B, it's a really oppressively high-security environment. They are obviously very happy with their tech, which is incredible for doing crowds. It's always been good since Blood Money, but it's got better. And so now there are literally hundreds and hundreds of people on this level everywhere. And then in addition to that, there's loads and loads of security everywhere. And in addition to that, both your targets have a full-time bodyguard following them absolutely everywhere. They never are alone. And that means there are ways to take them out. But again, you end up doing the pre-scripted thing that they've told you to do, which is you get the rat poison from the basement and you put it in the hors d'oeuvre that the bodyguard tastes every time he goes past the kitchen, and then he rushes the bathroom, and then you can take him out that way, and then you can do whatever interesting strategy you're going to do on the main target. And then for the other person's bodyguard, there's a different way to take him out. I can't remember off the top of my head what it is. I think you've got to take out another guard somewhere else, because not only should she have a guard with her at all times, she also never goes to a location that doesn't have at least one other guard. So to actually get her alone, you've got to take out the one of those guards that's isolated, hide him, wait for her to come around with the bodyguard, then take out the bodyguard without her seeing, which is tricky and very dependent on just like which way she's facing or like how close you are. Things that it tells you are silent attacks actually alert people nearby. And if she sort of knows you attacked her bodyguard in the split second before you manage to knock her out or something, it will alert everyone nearby. And so there's just loads and loads of stuff that I just can't play around with because there's no scope to do it. It's so oppressive. There's just people everywhere all the time. Everything is watched. I'm on like a high balcony in the dark, walking past, nowhere near the edge of it, and I'm told I've been recorded by a security camera because there's someone downstairs filming the catwalk, pointing in the opposite direction. I can see him, and apparently he's recorded me. That stuff is just everywhere. And so it's possible through like attrition and just long planning and hard work to thin out the guards enough that then you could do something cool, like stand in this one place and throw a battle axe at the person, or like get this cool weapon to this location and do this cool thing. But it's just so much work, and it's so much all of that stuff that you have to do to get into that situation is not freeform. I won't say there's only one way to do it, but there's just sort of prescribed ways of doing it. They've made sure that there is a way of doing it, which is nice, but it doesn't feel like a fun playground of like, oh, I can do this and get into that situation. And the reason that stuff is especially kind of punishing to do is that they, like Blood Money levels, it's kind of a clockwork dollhouse where everything's on a loop, but they also have loads and loads of story content they want to tell you about. And so the first time the target upstairs does her rounds,
her rounds are about 15 minutes long. Mm. And she has to go to about five different people and have these long conversations to explain all the plot to you.
Every time, yeah.
And you can follow her around. You can get a disguise where it's easy to follow her around and do all the stuff. But it just takes ages. And if you're trying for the kill that involves pushing her off the balcony, she's not going to go to the balcony for fucking ages. And you can't walk away and let her do her rounds because it stops happening when you're not there.
Right.
They wait until the next time you're there before the conversation will happen. So you just have to wait through it.
That's a... It's interesting, like, when you describe that stuff, because I was trying to imagine, I was trying to remember back to Blood Money levels and how they really differed, because they are so similar in many ways. One of my favourite levels is the Mardi Gras level, of course, where, and what you say about that kind of freedom of movement is so true of that level, where you've got this, it's basically like a square, formation of which is where the crowds are. And then between that square formation of the kind of the flowing crowds, there are these alleyways where things can happen if you're there at the right time. But you're basically completely free to move throughout that entire area. And so it's only very select, like the upstairs of the building where the drug deal is taking place. That's obviously going to be hard to get into, but there's an open window and there are sniper ways in there. And there are ways to get in and stuff.
And even that guy, even your actual ultimate target in that level, actually you've got several, but, both of them, and I think all the targets I can think of in that whole game, spend a good chunk of their cycle alone. They'll be in near guard some of the time, and they'll be it'll be very hard to get to the room that they're alone in. But once you're there, you have free reign of how you want to take them out because you have that chance. And for some reason, they've decided against that this time.
The opportunity system, the way that expressed itself in that particular level of Blood Money. Is the hanging piano, which is there's a piano hanging by. It's stupid that is there in that part of that corner of Mardi Gras, but the dangling piano is just all the visual indication I need that there's a way to use that. And the rest of it, I don't need a quest chain around.
Yeah,
that.
Exactly.
That's now a thing. I'm gonna bank that, and on maybe my next playthrough or the playthrough in the future, I'm gonna use that piano somehow. And that was always exciting part of discovering Blood Money's levels.
Yeah. It's also, I don't know why they changed the rating system too. The rating system used to be, it would give you kind of a phrase that described how you'd played, and Silent Assassin, which the second game was named after, was kind of the intended as the one you should go for, or like certainly an accolade to be achieved, which is where you only kill the targets. No bodies are found, and I think your cover's never blown. And then if you did something else, there was things like bag man and
loud dickhead.
Yeah, there was psychopath and there's hoodlum and all these other things. And so you didn't feel that, like, it did try and discourage just violence a little bit, but I personally never really cared about getting Silent Assassin, and I didn't mind if I lost some money or whatever for my performance, because it would give me some reflection of my performance. It would just say, you know, when it told me I was a psychopath, I wasn't thinking, oh damn, I was trying not to be. I thought, brilliant, that's exactly what I was going for. And this time, like, so the one time I did it quite sloppy the first time, and I lost 20,000 points or something off my final score because I killed two unnecessary people. It really judges you for that and tells you in game, you've killed a non-target, which I don't like because it makes me feel like those methods, all the methods that involve killing people except the targets, are now invalid. They're kind of, the game tells you they're wrong as you do them, which is 90% of the things I did in Blood Money. And then, so I redid it, and I did, basically, I went for the Silent Assassin thing. I only killed the targets. My cover was never blown. It took, like, literally 40 minutes or something, because the routes are so long. I had to wait so long for them to get into position at the right time, and then I'd realize, oh, shit, I don't have the poison I need to do this, and then I'd have to wait for the whole cycle to repeat again. But I eventually finally did it. I was picking off these guards, poisoning them in the right way, like, knocking them out, putting them in closets. And then I managed to, like, stab one guy with scissors and hide him. And then the other person, I think I killed with a kitchen knife or something. And, did it silently, stealthily, perfectly. Got out. My rating was 3 out of 5. No words, no judgment of any kind. It's just 3 out of 5. Yeah, you didn't kill any. You don't have any, like, penalty for killing non-targets. And you don't have any penalty for being seen. You don't have any penalty for that. But, you know. Could have done better, apparently, in some way. So it's just so, like, not binary, but linear. There's just one scale, and, like, whatever thing they have in mind, you were supposed to have done that. And if you do anything else, you just did a worse version of it.
I kind of want to come back to Hitman in 9 months' time when it has three levels or something. And then, because not all the levels were good in Blood Money.
Like, yeah, that's true.
Like the hit rate was probably about 60% good.
Yeah.
And probably slightly worse for other Hitmans. And there's, you know, it's quite possible that that weird kind of cocktail of player freedom and also wanted to give the player opportunities to do cool individual kind of stunt kills. Like that's such a hard balance to strike that maybe that's a balance that only gets struck like six in 10 times.
Yeah.
So
there was like the White House level of Blood Money had too much security and had the same problem where it was like claustrophobic. You couldn't really get away with anything cool.
I found the same thing with the Psych Ward one.
Yeah, that was it's like those two were probably my least favorite. Yeah.
So like they Blood Money has some duff levels as well. And likewise, actually, Absolution had like two or three proper sandbox levels that were actually, you know, half decent. Interesting.
I think it's the time thing that strikes me as the biggest betrayal. Like, yeah. You're right, those levels should be Clockwork Doll's Houses, but you shouldn't be the person prompting it to move on. Like, right.
Yeah.
There's lots of games that work the same way. Dishonored is the same type of game where the timings in that game become super important. And the more you understand, that's the satisfaction of learning the level isn't just being able to solve it in different ways, but being able to do things you definitely couldn't have done the first time because, you know, you wouldn't have known the exact time you can get to a certain place in time to meet someone coming the other way. Like, the fact that, I think part of the fantasy of those games is the fact that the levels kind of exist beyond you, that you're breaking a system that you're outside of, which is probably more appropriate to the Hitman fantasy, like as in that character, and we've spoken many times I think about how the whole point of that character is he sort of exists outside society and doesn't really get it and that kind of thing. And that is kind of broken the moment he's the center of the universe, prompting time to move on.
None of the conversations make sense if you're there. Like, they're all deathly secret things. They're about conspiracies and lies and stuff. And so if you're there, they should not say it. They should only speak if you're not around.
It's a perfect example of a game that needs believable human characters but doesn't need a story. If you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, Hitman, you should feel that you're in a... Well, doesn't it seem believable? Like, I agree that it can be sort of larger than life or exaggerated, again, to make you feel alienated from it. But it needs to take place in recognizably the real world. And real-world scenarios and things like that. But it doesn't need a through narrative. It just needs, you're in this place now.
Yeah.
Kill this person.
And that's kind of what Blood Money did. It had cutscenes to sort of notionally tie things together, but the cutscenes were just somebody later telling someone else about all the missions you did. Like, hey, that Hitman guy did these cool missions.
You'd think that the episodic format would be perfect for that as well.
Yeah.
It could just be like, here is Hitman doing Hitman things.
Mm. Yeah, they obviously just wanted these characters to have a story. Like, I don't know if it'll carry on or whether it'll relate to anything else, but they really felt like, because they're releasing this on its own, that it had to have its own narrative and its own kind of stuff to discover. A lot of it would be solved if it just had a fast forward button, which I'm sure is not a technically difficult thing to do, because they already have flexible timescale. Like, in every Hitman game previously, I don't know if this is true of this one, but you can bring down a console and just change the timescale manually. And right. I used to use that. Like, I used to hack the game to like accelerate when I wanted to wait. But in that case, it was only skipping like 30 seconds of waiting. In this case, it would be like 7 minutes of waiting. And they already have slow-mo in it. And I know this because it exacerbates the problem, because the only two modes in which you can see where your target are the map, in which case time is paused, or instinct vision, it's a dumb thing, but it's really useful this time in that you can see everyone through walls, and you can see your target through walls at any distance, and it actually looks really cool. They're all done like chalk outlines, which is kind of nice. But it slows down time. So if you're waiting for your target to get somewhere, you can use the instinct vision to see where he is, but while you're watching him, he'll move at a glacial pace. And when you look at the map, it pauses it, and you've got to wait, like I say, like 7 minutes or something. So you just have to kind of stand there in normal mode, like an asshole, just hoping he's in the right place, and every now and then checking. It's so weird. Should we do questions?
Sure, let's. Why not? Wow.
Questions, blimey. Wow.
Let's do questions, wow.
Good lord. A new catchphrase.
We'll find out. Rob writes, listening to the recent cast, you guys talked about how The Magic Circle failed, where a game of similar scope and merit, Firewatch, succeeded sales-wise, and primarily cited the disparity in art style. I think this is a good point, but looking past the immediate visuals, it seems that one of the games is about humans and humanity in a way that is approachable to pretty much anyone, whereas the other seem very much a game about games. Do you think there's some element of developers commenting on development that is holding them back by saying, by staying in a by gamers for gamers bubble? Should the Magic Circle devs really be surprised at poor sales when their game is for a pretty niche audience, other game developers and people interested in game development? Thanks for reading, Rob. And he adds the caveat, I should disclaim that I haven't played either of the games in question, but as a consumer who's interested in both, I think I get the gist of what they're selling. And when I find the time, I will buy Firewatch. And when I get find even more time, I'll buy the Magic Circle.
Yeah, I think there's probably some truth in that. Certainly, I think a lot of the people who bought Firewatch are never going to buy the Magic Circle and probably are not interested in the subject matter. But I was still, to be honest, I thought the subject of game, sort of games that never come out, was quite a big one for gamers. I mean, because you are, particularly if you're selling on Steam, you're selling to a bunch of people who know games really well and are kind of embedded in that community. And I thought, like, if you made, I'm not saying Magic Circle does this necessarily, but if you made a game that would appeal to anyone who was curious about why Duke Nukem Forever took so long, that would be a pretty big audience to hear.
I wouldn't be surprised if that's surprisingly small. Like,
hang on, if it's surprisingly small, wouldn't you be surprised by definition?
Would I?
You wouldn't be surprised if it was small enough that it surprised me.
I wouldn't. It would not be. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I've totally fucking thrown myself out. Simply because, you know, Steam is a big, Steam isn't a niche thing, right? Like, it is, does represent a big, obviously people, they're obviously, Steam's, yeah. Steam's market is people who are pretty engaged in buying games. They're not just like browsing a supermarket looking for something at random. But even so, I have to imagine that people who follow the history and drama of the games industry as a hobby in and of itself is a percentage of, a small percentage of the total people who are interested in games. Like, even from a, you know, from a, you know, Tom probably speaks this better than me, but like from a web traffic point of view, stories, you can do interesting stories about how things work out in the industry and they'll do reasonably well, but get obliterated by a new trailer for an upcoming game straight away, right? Like,
yeah, people don't necessarily care about how the sausage is made. They just want the new sausage. Yeah. It's what I've learned in years of
internet. The magic sausage.
Internet journalism. Certain stories do very well, specifically, like, so for example, if a big dump of new Star Wars 1313 footage emerged, like the cancelled Star Wars game that was supposed to be the big next gen game, people would love that, and they'd love to see it, but only in a kind of, so that they then get to kind of theory craft the game in their heads and imagine what it might have been, and kind of almost lifted up beyond what it probably would have been.
It's still about the product, you know. It's like a sneak peek at forbidden lost sausage.
Where, the forbidden, the lost Star Wars sausage. If you go to readers and say, "Do you want to see the lost Star Wars sausage?" they will always click on that. If you go and say, "Do you want to
hear the story of the lost sausage?"
Do you want to hear the quite embittered arguments between the creative departments involved in the creation of the sausage? No, not really. And that's kind of more what Magic Circle is actually about.
That's
It's about a lot of kind of embittered games process. Design
Magic Circle,
process
be inside the sausage.
And that's kind of where, like, I fell out of love with the Magic Circle, even though I wanted to love it so much, is that it felt like a lot of bugbears from being expressed in ways that weren't necessarily
Bugbear quest 4.
God, we've mixed so much imagery here.
What does this bugbear mean?
I don't know. Which is a shame.
I mean,
the word without knowing what it means.
Is it just when you got some bugs on you? Like some insects that are biting you and it's annoying.
But like, I don't know. Like,
there are a lot of bugs to bear.
I guess, but like a bear-sized bug.
That would be more than a minor.
That's terrifying.
That's one of the things.
That's one of my real bugbears.
That's one of the things you can control in the Magic Circle, I'm pretty sure, if you change behavior enough.
Bear-sized like bug.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a slight counterpoint. There's stuff like Zach Barth's TIS 100. It's not about game development, but it's like the game where you program a calculator, and it's super popular. Like, I don't know the exact numbers, but I think a lot more than Magic Circle.
Mm. But that is still fundamentally sausage. I mean, I'm not saying the Magic Circle is also sausage. But it's not about, you know.
I guess going back to like the questioner's suggestion that Firewatch is more popular because it's a more main, like people are a more mainstream subject.
Yeah.
More niche and more nerdy stuff in the Magic Circle can be more successful.
People are the sausage that doesn't stop being interesting.
The eternal people, the eternal sausage.
We've definitely resolved that one.
Yeah, that's solved as fuck. Also along the same lines, Tobin writes, "Dear Crate and Crowbar, I have the Magic Circle on my Steam wishlist as well. I have a rather limited gaming budget and only purchase games at a steep discount during sales. Whenever I hear positive or at least intriguing coverage for a game, I add it to my Steam wishlist so I can remember it when, one or two years down the line, it can be purchased for significantly less. Steam seems to encourage this behaviour by dropping shit on the floor, by sending out notifications when a game on your wishlist is on sale. This being said, I have a 0% likelihood of actually purchasing the Magic Circle for full price, and so I don't really represent a missed sale. I think a significant proportion of the Magic Circle's wishlist numbers may represent people with the same behaviour. Thanks to the great podcast, Tobin."
Yeah, it's an interesting point that the it was Magic Circle stats were 14,000 sales and 44,000 people have it on their wishlist. And that may not represent a lack of enthusiasm. It may just mean that that's the wrong price. Or, that those 44,000 people might not be people they could have got if they'd just, you know, done their marketing campaign better or tweet something about the game. They might just be people who are not going to buy that game at that price.
It's very easy to put something on a wish list. Like, it's a one-click process, right?
For what it's worth, I know some stats about other games and their wish list versus sales ratio, and that is unusually high. 44,000 to 14,000 is way more than...
As in, the discrepancy is high.
Right. Yeah, most games have fewer wish lists per sale, for example.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting that Steam does encourage that behavior. I don't think the wish list was invented for that. I think it was, you know, just to make sure that if you intend to buy something, you don't forget. And then when Steam sales became a much bigger part of it, they added a feature where it will actually notify you if something that's on your wish list is now available at a lower price. I think it even emails you.
Mm.
And so, yeah, they obviously encourage that behavior. And it's one of those things where it's like Steam sales themselves, sort of great in the short term, but people worry about it in the long term. Like on the immediate scale, yeah, the first time it happens, all the people who buy it at the lower price are probably people who weren't going to buy it at the higher price. So great, loads and loads of sales that you weren't going to get. And then in the long run, you sort of train people not to buy it full price, and then it becomes very difficult to sell your new game at full price. And, you know, arguably maybe the Indiepocalypse thing that started this whole discussion is the effect of that, that people are more reluctant to buy things at full price. One of the things that came out of it, one of the sort of lessons for developers, was that maybe people need to be thinking about reasons that your players might want to play at launch, some special reason to do that, i.e. multiplayer games are going to do better in that environment because you want to be playing when everyone else is, and it's less appealing to wait 9 months and then get it in a sale when maybe no one is playing it at that point.
They also did that thing with, I think it was a couple of Steam sales, maybe they still do it, where... you had like through their various mini games and giveaway stuff, you had a chance of winning one of the games that was on your wish list.
Oh.
But you had to have like a wish list of like 10 games or more or something like that. So they've really done various little experiments to like encourage wish list padding. And obviously, you would only put games you actually did want because you had a chance at winning them. But that might make over time more stuff like that happens. I presume they're data gathering, but it also might muddy the data for the individual games. Like, it might give a good broad sense of what people are interested in, but not for those individual games. You don't really know. Yeah, like, there's lots of different factors in the intent behind any given decision to click wishlist this for me.
They did mention some stats with the... I can't remember if it was the Lunar sale or the one before it. They changed the way that games were promoted to people. Instead of doing sort of these Valve pick... like 10 games to be deeply discounted and promote them heavily. Everyone who is part of the sale as a developer only set one discount, and so there was no highlighting of individual games. They encourage you to sort of do a deep discount, and then instead of promoting 8-10 games to everybody, they did it much more algorithmically based on your preferences and using the kind of the queue system and the whatever the name for kind of the personalized Steam store is. And they said they saw way better results than that, like loads more sales and loads more things being added to wish lists and loads more things on wish lists being bought and stuff like that.
Interesting. James writes, "Dear Hacks and News Hounds, during last week's pod,
Chris, or possibly one of the Toms, said that he was the only one of you.
No one knows who we are, do they?
Yeah. No one has a clue.
Now that the Scottish guy is gone, there's nothing to distinguish us.
It was me, Tom.
Oh God, I'm never going to understand that. No, I'm Chris.
It was me. Chris said that he was the only one of you who is still in the journalism bucket, because Tom Senior wasn't here last week. This got me pondering. Every week, I listen to you all bring me the week's gaming news, discuss your critical opinions of the week's releases, and even run a letters page. My personal take had always been that this made you all journalists of some form, even the ones who no longer write for a website. What do you all think? Where do you draw the line? Do Let's Players count? Do you think that we should make more of a distinction between games journalists and games critics? Does something like Richard Cobbett's excellent and sadly missed crapshoot column count as journalism, despite discussing 20-year-old games? Thanks for the great pods, and I'm looking forward to Pip joining as a regular, James.
Yeah, I still do a whole bunch of stuff that fall under the sort of category of playing other people's games and then talking about them in some critical fashion, usually analytical, usually to say, like, this part works and this part doesn't. I do Let's Plays. I also covered some talks at GDC for PC Gamer. The thing I don't do at all is review stuff, and I haven't replaced that with anything. You know, I talk about games here on the podcast, but we don't give them scores or anything. Even, you know, my blabbing about Hitman tonight has not been a review. I haven't played it fully enough to review it, and I like that. I thought I'd miss reviewing. I loved it when I was a journalist, but as soon as I didn't have to do it, every time I play a game, I think, thank God I'm not reviewing this. Like Far Cry Primal, it's great that I'm not reviewing it, because I'm still not even like 3/4 of the way through it after, you know, 40 hours or something. And if I had that time pressure of like, oh, I really ought to see all the content before I pass judgment on it, all of the things that delay you seeing that content would be frustrating to me. Whereas just as a normal player, I'm really enjoying taking my time with it and all that.
I mean, that was a specifically really interesting example that you ended up loving a game that most reviewers didn't rate because you switched off half of the features, which a reviewer couldn't do because their job is literally to look at those features.
Yeah.
I think more broadly in this question, I think Tom and I are on the same page, like, aside from what it says on the piece of paper that means I get money for living, it doesn't really matter what I am in the games, in the business of saying stuff about games on the internet.
Yeah.
Like, technically, yeah, journalist is probably the thing that fits if you wanted to delineate me from other people making games about stuff. Probably more accurate to say dude who writes things of various kinds, sometimes esports coverage, sometimes reviews. And even within that, there's huge distinctions in what you actually do. Like, you can get your coverage of games in so many different forms now. Like, if what you want is to hear somebody talk about a game for whatever purpose, you're thinking you're buying it, you enjoy it, and you want someone else's, share someone else's enthusiasm, you have so many different ways of getting that, that to my mind, it doesn't really matter what each of them is called necessarily. Like, on the previous podcast, I said I'm still a journalist where other people aren't, specifically because the question was calling out professional game reviewers, and maybe actually one of the mistakes I made in that case was sort of agree with his definition of what that was, because actually, to be honest, I don't think I do. But yeah, I don't know if you feel the same way, Tom.
Yeah, pretty much. I think there's a unnecessary power attached to the title of journalist or critic when the power is actually completely in the mind of the reader. And it's about who you trust and who you like to hear opinions from. And that's kind of the cool thing about this podcast, is that we bring lots of people from lots of different disciplines in, not just journalists. And if you like what people say and the way they say it and agree with their methodology and the way they think about things, then that to you, that's a good source, whether it's they're labeled a journalist or whether they're labeled a developer or anything else.
I mean, if you find like people should naturally gravitate towards the forms of coverage is probably the best catch-all phrase. That they find either entertaining or useful.
Yeah.
Like, without getting into too much, we did have another question along these lines that was way more hostile about this sort of thing, and particularly about what a review is or isn't. And it's totally fine to disagree with all of us about what a review is or isn't, and when it should be objective or not. Because you fully have the option of finding your critical opinion elsewhere. I think, I don't like the notion that there's a sort of, ironically, an objective standard of what a reviewer is and what a journalist is and what a critic is actually ultimately a little bit unhelpful, because we live in a world where increasingly all of this stuff is free and as available as each other. So people are fully within their power to get, you know, get their coverage in whatever form kind of suits them.
Yeah.
I'd be the last person to say that you should go and read an article or read a written review rather than watch a Let's Player because it's objectively going to give you a better critical opinion. That'd be absurd. Like, go to the thing that you find personally most entertaining and useful.
I know some Let's Plays are fucking amazing. Like, a Let's Play of a very complicated game by someone who understands its systems completely and has played it 10 times can be better than playing the game.
Yeah.
So straight up.
I mean, I talked before about for Soma, I ended up watching Christopher Odd's playthrough of it because there were certain things I didn't like about the actual way the game was played, but I was really interested in the plot and the story. And also then it turned out he was way better at getting the story out of the game. He would study every part of it and understand how things connected to each other.
Yeah, yeah.
He's since done a bunch of XCOM videos, and turns out he's a fucking amazing XCOM player. So he plays on like Impossible and Iron Man and everything, and that's really interesting to watch too.
And often, like, sometimes Let's Plays are so good that they actually make the game worth buying because you can kind of experience it and kind of enjoy it alongside people. And that's kind of awesome and remarkable to me. And I like to think that that's what some of hopefully our diary features do as well. It's just get your media from wherever you want it.
We're ultimately in the business of making games more entertaining from a whole bunch of different angles, whether that's actually talking about experience in a game that makes both is entertaining in itself and makes the game more entertaining, or whether that's steering people towards the games they might find entertaining.
Yeah, sure.
And there are different ways of achieving all those things, but I'd certainly say that like all of this has moved away from strict product reviewing. That's actually very hard to that's actually relatively hard to find now, I'd say.
Yeah, towards the tech sector stuff is very, very kind of product oriented, isn't it?
Tech journalism, you know, game journalism has this weird dual heritage.
Yeah, it's
obviously, and then the proportions shift based on where you go geographically. Like the further east you go in Europe, the more tech starts to take over. And the you get to Britain and I think historically, actually, it's far more like music journalism and film journalism than tech journalism.
You get much more experiential kind of,
much more subjective. And then over in the US, it's a bit more, again, a little bit closer to tech in some cases, but it's such a big place that it's, and more recently, it's diversified so much.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, when you're into the business of this stuff, that drawing those kinds of lines is kind of interesting. But more broadly, drawing a line is like, nah, just hopefully make things people don't hate about games. And people hate it.
Yeah, they'll always hate it.
Yeah.
Someone will always hate it.
I had a question that's actually related to this that I was thinking about because I was listening to Video Games Hot Dog, in which Zach Johnson says a bizarre thing where if there's two Zelda games, and because I don't know the Zelda series well, I can't remember what their names are, but there's two Zelda games, and he says if someone put a gun to his head and forced him to play one of them, he would pick, I think it was Ocarina of Time, because it's his only opportunity to be forced to play that game. Like, he actually prefers, or thinks the other one is probably he would like more, but he kind of wants to see all the story and stuff, and so if he has the opportunity to be forced to play it, then he'd take that. And I remember this about reviews. I would sometimes want to review something because I know I'm never going to play it otherwise, or I need to be actually like sat down in a room and paid to play it in order for me to play it. But if I do, I'll enjoy it. Do you guys have games like that?
Not really. Maybe?
I don't know. I want someone to force me to play Dwarf Fortress.
Because
I think with enough input, that game would give me so much back.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the genesis of Dota for me, I suppose. Was we need to solve the problem if we can't cover this game.
Right.
It was you saying that. Like, started that. I think, like, I tend to want to review things that where I'm kind of invested in seeing whether or not it's succeeded or failed critically. Like, I wouldn't necessarily throw my hat in the ring to review something because I want to tell you, like, I don't know, I don't necessarily just want to kick the tires. Like, I'm invested in a review because I want to find out, has it been, you know, successful at this ambitious thing it wants to do, or is it successful at bringing back this genre that isn't necessarily as, you know, popular anymore or something like that.
I would like to be enforced to play Pillars of Eternity. I did play Pillars of Eternity for a bit, but I didn't sort of bounce off it hard or anything. I didn't have any big problems with it. I just sort of had one particularly frustrating battle, and I wasn't invested enough to kind of keep soldiering on. But I sort of wish someone would force me to play it. I don't think it'd be a good one for me to review, because I don't know the lineage well enough to kind of be authoritative about it. But it's one where I know I would get a lot out of it eventually.
I mean, the thing is, with a game like that, like, that's another case where, I mean, I remember like Pillars, like very close to launch, like the single piece of coverage of that game that did best by every metric for PC Gamer was Chris Livingston's diary, where he tried to play the game as six bears.
Oh yes.
And like, you know, for you can draw the lines you want about what is and isn't a review and what a review should or shouldn't be, but ultimately I suspect that article more usefully told more people whether or not they would like that game. Even, you know, I mean, and Andy, who reviewed it for us, did a really good review, but it's like, again, what people find engaging or, you know, useful just varies so much.
It might have been why I played, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
I will say my beginner's guide did outperform the Bear Diary.
Oh, did it? Oh, really?
Nice.
It was just a basic combat guide, which is probably less reflection on the piece I did, and more reflection on the fact that that game doesn't teach you a load of really basic shit about how its combat system works, and people actually have to come to us to get it.
Thanks, game. Thanks,
so, yeah. There's a weird form of criticism. You should, you should cover every aspect of a game and see what people are searching for after the fact to determine what the game itself is failing at doing.
Yes, they review it
and
based
then
on that.
Give it a score based on that. There's your absolutely flawless crowdsourced critical system.
The latest Chris Livingston diary you should read is the. Let me see if I can get this title right. Enforcer, Police Crime Action Diary. Oh, yeah. Sounds like a made-up title, but it's like a whisker away from Police Cops from The Simpsons. But it's a game where you play as a police officer, but they also simulate like all of your life, down to like you buying interior decorations for your apartment and calling your grandparents, who, in Chris's case, never pick up the phone. it's diary of that.
Chris Livingston is the best, and it's definitely great that we hired him.
Yeah.
He's ours now.
Yeah. Graham's not here for us to make things.
I saw him out at GDC. Yeah. That was nice.
Excellent man. Top Chris. Probably the best Chris.
Brilliant dog as well.
Excellent dog. Yeah. Anyway, that's...
yeah.
If you want us to get onto PC Gamer's best dog...
It's a good... Actually...
It's a very contested field now.
Tyler is...
Tyler's got it. This is totally...
Anyway.
Yeah. We can't show pics because...
No, you're right.
No, yeah. So therefore, we shouldn't promise him. Let's move on. Brian writes, "Hi folks, I'm curious, what's so terrible about your current living situation? Admittedly, I'm writing from a place of ignorance as an American, but pictures make it seem almost idyllic. I get that things can be misinterpreted. I do live in Colorado, after all, but I'm wondering why it sucks. Also, do you ever get a funk with games and not really have much interest in them? Does this affect your mood as you're required to write about games? Currently, I really love the idea of games, but I can't sit down in front of one for more than 20 minutes, as I go quickly bored and need to do something productive instead, or just find another way to be lazy." Brian. I can't remember exactly when we moaned about living in Bath.
I think it's an ongoing kind of, you know.
I think the key is not necessarily being American and not knowing what Bath is like. The key is not necessarily knowing the way in which British people traditionally describe how things are right now.
Yes.
Which is ass shit.
Yeah. Moaning about the weather. Moaning about where you live, even though it's beautiful,
yeah,
and wonderful and crime free,
yeah,
and just the living embodiment of a postcard that you get to walk around,
yeah,
every single day with a big peaceful
country. My you know, beautiful crime free beige beer paradise doesn't really have enough edge for me.
Yeah.
I have heard that houses in America are generally larger.
That's true. There's more space. There's much more space.
Yeah. In terms of the funk, I have had it.
Terrible
Let us
funk.
Now address the funk.
No funk in Bath.
You were never going to get a better cue for a slap bass solo, Tom. And that moment is gone.
In terms of the funk, I've had like very short ones where, like, the other day I was I just wanted a break from work, and I wanted to play something with a gamepad, which ruled out Deadbolt, which is what I'm actually playing at the moment, which is really cool. And I love Far Cry Primal, but the chaos part of it does mean that every now and then you're just attacked by seven things at once, and you can get out of it if you take it seriously, but when I'm annoyed and I'm trying to do something else, I don't take it seriously, and then I get killed, and I get frustrated, and I quit. So I quit that. Then I fired up Hitman, and like something went wrong, and I lost a load of progress, because you have to manually save all the time, and I got pissed off with that. and then I played, I think, Super Hot for a while, and I had some good moments in that, and then I got annoyed about some, I don't know, just dodging bullets or something. No, I think I was trying to lead people, and I kept missing, and then ran out of bullets and got annoyed with it. And yeah, so I often have that thing where I just play like four different games and all of them annoy me in some way, and to the point that I quit them, and then I just sit there and think, fuck, I have nothing that I want to play.
Yeah. I think my kind of equivalent of a funk, like I'll always play a new game, I always get really excited about playing a new game. And even if it's, you know, everyone has said it's terrible. Like the ritual of booting up and seeing the kind of intro screens and everything and kind of going into it, and it's brand new and I haven't been fucked by it yet. It hasn't annoyed me yet. So, you know, every time I start a new game, I always think it could be an amazing game, even no matter what everyone has said about it.
Every game is perfect until it's loaded. Your Steam library is perfect.
and then it turns out to be deeply mediocre, and then I get sad and turn it off.
You don't. If it's mediocre, you'll play it in 2 years.
Well, there are degrees of mediocrity, I think, actually.
Okay.
We'll go into that in a different podcast, I think. But the wider kind of malaise strikes when there's no game I'm into, that I'm really into and obsessed with. So my answer was XCOM 2, because I had to review it. But there's a kind of cathartic sprint you do when you review something, where you get like enormously, enormously into it. And once the review's turned in and everything's done, it feels as though somehow that's finished. Whereas, like, that game is not finished for me. There's going to be way more pleasure I'll get out of it. But because the review process is so kind of fraught, it feels like work still to do it. And Destiny is hibernating at the moment. And The Division disappointed me. And there's nothing to be into. And Diablo 3 isn't really holding my attention anymore. So there's no game that's really kind of obsessing my thoughts and kind of really.
Far Cry Primal.
It's Primal.
Total Warhammer is like a week away.
Well, maybe I'll.
Isn't it?
What's that?
Like April, Total Warhammer, right? Am I wrong?
Have
I gone mad?
I think it may have been delayed to May.
Oh, shit.
A little bit, yeah. No, that'll be probably the next one. But until then, you know, I feel like, what am I going to do? What's my new obsession going to be? And I love being really into a game and really into its systems and thinking about it all the time and kind of theory crafting around it. And I just, when I don't have that, I feel like that's my kind of funk. And I'm in that at the moment.
Yeah, I think I'm in a little bit of that at the moment. I just finished XCOM. Mm. But even then, towards the end of that, I was like, I feel like I had gotten it, but I wanted to have finished it.
Mm.
The thing that occupies all my brain time, like my idle. My fucking idle clock cycles in my brain when I'm not thinking about something else is the X-Wing miniatures game now. So maybe that's just sort of stepped in. But I think that's not to do with me getting tired of games generally, but
just that it's probably a better game than
most of the games that are out now. Destiny before that was a big one. I think more generally, like, I've definitely had times in my life where I was like, maybe what if I give up games? That's when you instantly overnight become an author or something.
Time gets back to you.
Right? Yeah. Like the kind of, you know, is this a distract? Cause essentially when your job is rating distractions based on how distracting they are, you can get kind of drawn into the idea that, what if it's all a distraction? And sometimes that can put you in a bit of a funk about, you know, the medium and everything else. Right. But I don't know. If it's the thing I keep coming back to and the thing I find so consistently engaging and can't really stay away from for very long before finding something else that I find really interesting and exciting, then I sort of find it hard to sustain the idea that it's all a giant waste of time. But it might be. Any other borderline depressing thoughts about whether or not we're wasting our lives?
I'm going to go back to XCOM 2, but I want it to... I'd love it if they put in 360 controller support, because it's got Steam controller support, but no other game pads at the moment. If they don't, I just need it to actually work with my Steam controller. Like, my Steam controller technically works with it, but it doesn't use the configuration that they've set up for it. It uses some random combination of buttons, and so it's really shitty to use. And if they can fix that, that'd be good.
Finally, Noel writes, "Hello, I'm going to pronounce this wrong. Crew and Crovandamar. I'm shamelessly reusing this Neil Gaiman pun from a previously submitted and much worse question." Read Neverwhere if you don't know it. I love the...
That was good. The backhanded.
I guess he's reusing one of his own questions. Because if not, that's actually kind of admirable arrogance. Like, I've stolen this pun from a lesser man.
Who I killed.
Or woman, actually. Noel can be either, or is it Noel? I don't know. I'm a student of music at university, and part of that is music history. Specifically, the romantic ideal of the sublime. For those listeners without English or music degrees, the sublime is that combination of awe, terror, and danger evoked usually by nature and by music like, oh, for God's sake, Berlioz? Tommy, you'll know this.
I can't see the screen from here.
B-E-R-L-I-L.
Berlusconi?
By Silvio Berlusconi's Symphony Fantastique.
Corrupt.
He is terrifying.
B-E-R-L-I-O-Z.
I'll leave that up to the readers.
I thought the musician knew would know.
No,
anyway, and art like Ward's Gordale Scare. Oh, for fuck's sake,
this is a dangerous email to select for the last email of the evening.
Oh God, why have you done this? I often feel the sense of the sublime in Minecraft, looking at the vast horizons. Hmm. Are there any other games in which you experience this? Thank you for visually taking in and understanding this email that I have written, everyone.
Barely.
Barely being able to pronounce things I should probably be able to pronounce. No. So.
Good question.
It's a good question. I do agree that games are pretty good at doing, I think, you know, games are pretty good at doing sublimity, particularly, I mean, we're going to say in terms of horror.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're kind of.
It's kind of based over the linked concept of it.
Like, yeah, yeah. Like, awesome. It comes from the idea of something being.
Just the idea that a mountain is not only beautiful in a way that you observe it and the way the sun bounces off it is beautiful and it's extraordinary, but also it's kind of something terrifying and unknowable and unknowably huge about it that reduces you into nothing.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And that, I guess. As nature does.
Now that you put it that way. Eve's map.
Mm.
You know, when you like the proper galactic map where you see every star in 3D and you rotate around the whole thing, that's kind of like, yeah, beautiful and terrifying.
That's the point, yeah.
I'm not sure that games, I mean, I think a lot, the obvious choice for this would be like an open world game, like the kind of classic Bethesda, see that mountain, you can go there thing.
Yeah.
But I think that's actually kind of the opposite of what this is, because like you go to the throat of the world in Skyrim, which is this massive mountain. And eventually you kind of reduce it with your presence to like a staircase you as part of the level.
Yeah, you conquer it.
And like that kind of, this is, oh God, I'm on the edge of saying something really wanky. There's a bit in The Prelude by William Wordsworth where he's rowing on a lake. It's a really good example of sublime in literature from the same period, which is where he's sort of rowing on a lake and then he sort of has to row away because he feels like the mountain's actually coming towards him. Like the sort of the perspective shift that, you know, as you get close, you know, even though the mountain's just sort of looming in the distance, that sense of its sort of enormity means you can't tell if it's moving. You know what I mean? The idea that this thing has sort of like a sense of motion, even simply because it's massive. Like that's the whole point of the sublime is like these kind of images getting detached from physics and it all becoming completely subjective, your experience of them is as things, whereas games are just things in space, right? Like they have an absolute kind of quality and you're the sort of master of that with how you move around.
Yeah, there's also a big temporal aspect to nature and the sublime as well, where it's about ancient, unthinkably ancient constructs that have pre-existed you for so long and will, you know, exist beyond you for so long. And games, I don't know how they can.
Shadow of the Colossus would be a good example of a game that sort of touches on this stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, it's kind of a very obvious way because it's really big stuff. It's sad.
Sure.
Yeah. And then climb on it and kill it, right?
Yeah, but even so, like, it does more, it has more emotional nuance in that act than, like, the way you climb on and kill a mountain in Skyrim, which is just by kind of like reducing it to a zone, right?
Yeah.
And shouting Fusrodar at someone on the top so you can watch their ragdolls.
Watching a bear ragdolling off a hill is like the end of. The Wordsworth didn't do that.
Or you do that ridiculous thing where, you know, how.
I ragdolled lonely tumbling bear.
Like, yeah, exactly.
How like motion and gradients work in video games, where if you do the zigzag up the gradient, you can kind of slide your way up an absurd surface to the top of a mountain. And
Far Cry Primal is really good at dealing with that. Okay. It's got, and Far Cry 3 and maybe even 2 have great slope handling, where like if you jump up a slope, you can kind of skid down them, and it has a really good, like, consistent sense of which things are scalable and which things are not. Mm. Anyway, carry on.
And there's no way that a mountain will fill beyond your kind of ken in a video game.
Because except it's in the really just... except if it's part of the skybox, right? They're like, yeah, we have plenty of things in video games that you can't get to and interact with, but that's the thing we've been pissed off about, and they don't inspire awe because we don't see them as real.
Halo is traditionally quite good at this.
Right.
Halo's just about big stuff.
Superstructures in space.
Superstructures in space.
Oh, yeah, the Halo itself.
The Halo ring. Like, the idea is you get arrive in this thing, you see it stretching off into the horizon.
And that is just a skybox, but you kind of believe in it a bit more.
Yeah, and then in Halo, and the fact that the game itself has like a logical geographical progression that shows you ultimately how little distance you've actually traveled.
Nice.
And, like, in Halo 3, you get to the Ark, which is the machine that makes Halos. And you see a fresh one being kind of born out of this massive machine from the side of it. And you have that sense of like, well, that was huge previously. And this is bigger. Mm. And I'm the same size. So, wow.
Because that's how humans are.
In conclusion, wow.
Nice.
Brain agrees. Wow.
Kind of a weird answer to this is an indie game called The Wall, or On the Wall or something, where the entire game... takes place on the side of a completely vertical white wall, and the only way you can, you know, not fall to your death is just on these little platforms that you kind of pull out of it, and you have a tool that kind of just yanks bits of the wall out, and then you climb on them. But it's a real, like, it is kind of chilling. Like, it gives me, you know, if you have any trace of vertigo in your body, you will experience in this game, because there is an infinite drop below you, and there's infinite expanse above you and in all directions, and it's just... everything on your right is solid wall, and everything on your left is infinite empty space, and in every other direction is infinite empty space. And it's, I guess, that like the sense of awe comes from, like, it's really ambiguous as to what this place is, or like it looks man-made, and so that's kind of how I read it. And the idea that this was built ever is kind of mind-boggling. You know, it kind of never could be built because it's infinitely large. And it's so outside of the scope of anything in reality or even in other video games that it really does sort of stir something in you, or in me anyway. I look at it and just think, fuck, this is weird.
In conclusion, fuck, this is weird.
I think that's the Sublime, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's what, you know, romantic, capital R romantic poetry is essentially a way of avoiding saying fuck.
Fuck. Wouldn't have really passed, would it?
Try not to say fuck.
He wrote fuck and then he died of consumption. Celebrated for the ages.
Wow.
Good.
In conclusion, wow.
Wow.
And that's all the wow we have time for.
You can send us questions at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. You can tweet them at us. We are @crateandcrowbar on Twitters. You can put them on our forum, which is crateandcrowbar.com/forum. You can hang out with us on our Discord channel, which is on the website at crateandcrowbar.com. And you can follow us individually. I'm @pentadact, PENTADACT. Chris is?
@cthurston, CTHURSTEN.
And Tom Sr. is?
@PCDLudo, which is LUDO.
That's
wow.
Everybody.
Wow.
Wow.
Wow, indeed.